Welcome to the Been There, Done That podcast with Angela Dunn Cartledge.
Welcome, everybody, to this very special episode. This is not the normal format that you're used to hearing or watching. My name is Shelby Ring, and I wanted to take the opportunity to interview Angela and hear her story today, because I know she facilitates for so many people and their processes and what they've gone through. And I want to take a deep dive and hear her story. So Angela, thank you for being on your show today.
Thank you so much for offering to do this. I'm really excited to have this opportunity, and to get the opportunity to talk to you is just a joy. So thank you so much for being here for this.
Yes. So I want to start off in the beginning. Essentially, how did your fertility journey start?
I would say that from a really young age, I wanted to be a mom. I thought that that was the answer to all the questions that I always had about being a grown-up. And I followed the typical society ideal that you get married and then you start to try to have babies. And I did that. And within the first year of us getting married or being married, we talked about it. We sort of decided that it was a good idea to start trying, and we did that. And 2 years in, there was no changes. There were no indications of anything approaching pregnancy. So that's when the shift happened for us, where it goes from being a fun process to not a fun process, where you're starting to think about silly things like, okay, well then if I dump myself upside down off the bed after all the things are finished, then everything sits in my uterus longer. And you think about buying at the time there were these basically little pH sticks that would tell you whether or not you were ovulating, and you do all of that stuff. And I was marching all the way through my cycle and keeping up with all these different details, and that still wasn't working either. So that all those things were happening. And
how old were you when in this chapter of life?
I would say, let's see, 1 year into marriage would have been 24.
Okay.
So I feel like young now, looking back at it. But then at the time, it felt like I was old in the process of trying to get this done. So it's all about perspective, right? You learn as you go. Things aren't what they seem at the time, especially when you're 24. So yeah, at that point, then I was starting to think that I needed to involve other people, start to talk to a doctor, start to think about what that might look like. But yeah, so then it progressed from there, where there were questions to doctors, and you get everything in advice that is very medically sound. In there are these options that you can go through where you're taking extra hormones and those kinds of things, and maybe we should go in and do a scope and look around and make sure that you don't have endometriosis or PCOS or anything of those nature. And then the other way, where people say awesome things to you like, well, just have a couple of glasses of wine, that'll calm you down. That was one of my favorites, was don't think about it so much. And at the time, I was willing to listen to anybody's advice. I wanted all the advice because I thought, I don't know what I'm doing. So surely everybody else, especially those that didn't have to try very hard to get pregnant, their advice should be golden. Anything that they say should be the thing that will get me there. And in my experience, nobody else in my family, even extended family, had any fertility issues at all. In fact, it had been the opposite. Mm-hmm. And so I felt like I really didn't have anybody that I could go to talk to about it, to ask any questions, to really be able to dig in, except for medical professionals. So I feel like that was sort of the shift psychologically in, okay, now I need to move into a space where I'm asking questions, where I need to ask somebody what's going on. And like I said, the advice was all over the place. You get very random advice that's reduce your stress, exercise more, eat these foods, don't eat these foods. And then it moves into things that are otherworldly. I did do acupuncture. I did yoga to try to reduce the stress and to do all the things. And that none of that worked, of course. And so it was expensive things at that point I'm dealing with. The change in the identity, because I grew up in the 80s where most of what we talked about with regard to sex was that you could become a statistic. You could become a teenage pregnancy statistic and you'd have to drop out of high school. And these are life-changing events that you would have to deal with.
Did you have any friends or I know family, you're saying there was not infertility was not relevant. Did you acquire any friends during that time that also were having troubles conceiving?
I did a little bit at a time. And I think the hardest part was that even as women, we didn't, especially then, we didn't trust each other to be able to talk about it. Mm-hmm. And so it was very difficult to communicate about it in a way that we could have helped each other. So everybody that I learned had similar experiences to me, had to be in a very desperate place to bring it up. It wasn't the kind of thing that we talked about over coffee. There was no social media. We didn't have a way to connect in a way that felt a little bit less vulnerable. We didn't have that. So the way that we did connect would have been through somebody else. My sister-in-law was always incredibly supportive and always incredibly helpful in wanting me to have people to talk to. And so if she experienced anybody in her life, then she would send them my way or vice versa. She would send me to them and we would be able to connect that way. But most of the time when I did connect with anybody, it was after the fact. It was after I had gotten pregnant because that seemed to instill hope in someone else. And they were able to then talk to me about their experiences and what should I do about this. So it was a lot different than it is now, but I think it's better in some ways now and worse in some ways now because, social media just adds a layer of communication, but it doesn't always give authenticity. So, it was a little harder.
Tell me about chapter two. You're that many years into conceiving, recognizing, all right, something's not lining up. I need support. What was the next chapter?
Well, like I said, acupuncture was a big thing then, for me at least, to thinking that I could realign my body somehow, and that would do something to help me get there. Tried acupuncture for a little over a year. I did intrauterine inception twice with Clomid, the booster drug, and did that twice and that failed. Meanwhile, I'm still getting advice from people, especially those that care about me. If there was any level of stress or if I was ever communicating any level of not knowing what to do next, any level of concern or anything, then I would immediately get feedback and immediately get advice to just stop. That the next thing to do is to just be a good aunt, or be a dog mom, and just be cool with that. And I just couldn't seem to get there. I wanted to feel comfortable with that answer. I wanted desperately that to not have to want this, because it was so hard to want this to happen, that I felt like I wanted to give up so many times, but I just couldn't. I was just compelled to not do that yet. And kept tracking my ovulation, kept doing all of those things, never had a positive pregnancy test. And then my husband decided to go back to school. He was going to get a graduate degree in physical therapy. And during that time was when the doctor that I was seeing suggested a in vitro study where they were going to do a placebo group and a new drug group, and then see what happened. It would create a situation where we wouldn't have to pay for the exorbitant cost of IVF, but the process would be the same. I did all the tests. I was told by a doctor that she had no idea why I was there, that there's no reason why I wasn't able to conceive on my own. There's no reason for you to be part of this study, blah, blah, blah. And then a second doctor coming in to give me a second opinion to say, you're a perfect candidate for this study because you don't have explained infertility. This is a great opportunity for us to see if this works without you having to go through any other procedures, anything else to try to figure out what was going on. And we both had an unexplained infertility. So we didn't have consistency on either side. It doesn't feel that long ago, Shelby. Like, I look at the time frame and I think we're still in the 21st century. Like, we're not talking about, you know, changing the century mark even. But yet it was still, it's still light years away from where we are now. So that was the next step that we took. There was nothing that kept us from being a part of this study, except for the fact that my husband was in graduate school and I was working full time. And so there was that piece of it where I was supporting him through his next dream.
Yeah. And what year was that? Ish.
That was in 2007.
Yeah. Yeah. The tech. Oh my gosh. Yes. It's hitting so hard what you're describing.
Yes. But it's so different now. And even then, going through a study was so simple. I didn't know the difference. And we ended up with the placebo. So we didn't have anything that was really different about our process. So we started the in vitro process. And my husband found out that he was going to be not living at home for his first internship of his graduate school series. And so that was awesome to know that there's only certain places I can actually reach. And at the time, I was supposed to be giving myself a shot in the rear part of my leg every day. And so I thought, oh, that'd be interesting. I'm going to have to enlist some help. And so we did. We had really good friends that lived in the same apartment complex as us. The wife was a PT student with Brian, and the husband was working with me. We were at the same company, so we were really good friends. And he helped. And he came over and gave me my shots. And so that process was, I can't describe the level of physical pain that your body is going through, because you're sheltered and held really tight. You're not ovulating. Nothing's happening in your body. Okay. Ovulation. You get slammed forward into this hormonal tailspin so that they can control every step of the process, right? And it's, I'm so thankful to have had the option. I don't ever want that to sound like I'm not thankful or grateful that I had the option of what this looks like. Because I know there's a lot of questions right now around fertility and around treatments and all those things that are a big deal to people across the country. But it isn't easy. It is not an easy process to go through, not physically and not mentally. This was at the almost 10-year mark of our marriage and 10 years of trying at that point. So at that point, and as you and I have already talked about, you get to a point where this thing that is happening to your own body is no longer something that you connect with. You can't, you're separated from it on purpose because you have to emotionally to stay sane and keep your feet on the ground, that you're doing this to your own body, but it feels disconnected. It doesn't feel like it's actually happening to you. But it was very painful, and I would bruise, and I would have these lumps that I would have to work out with heating pads and all kinds of stuff. The medicine would cause a knot in my muscle because they were all intramuscular injections. Meanwhile, logging all these things because of being part of the study, that it kind of added this second layer of logistics that we had to participate in and keep that stuff going. So all of that happens. My husband comes back from internship, and then we have a positive pregnancy test for the first time in my whole life. Elation. I don't know how better to describe the feeling of not just the excitement of knowing that all of this was culminating into this thing that I had really been driving and wanting my whole life, but also there's this piece of me where I was just glad that we were done for a little bit, that we could just say, okay, cool. I don't have to match it. I don't have to do any cycles. I don't have to do anything. And what that then replaced in my body was, now I have to do everything I can to try to keep me and the baby safe. And you have no control over that at all. Zero. And even in this day and age, we still have maternal mortality around birth because it is just a really tragic, traumatic thing that happens to us. And you think, well, if I just, again, eat the right foods and I drink lots of water, and I get good sleep, and I don't get too stressed, because you can definitely control that. And I make sure that I am thinking good thoughts, and I'm spinning around twice before I lay down in bed. I can definitely make a difference with that. I can definitely keep the baby safe. You can't. You have no idea what you're doing. And so you go through all of that, and then now you're replacing it with a new emotional fear. My new fear was, great, I've gotten all this done. I've gotten all the way to here, and I still have no control over whether or not this actually works. So that was in the summer to early fall of 2007.
Okay.
And then Brian was going to graduate. My husband was going to graduate from physical therapy graduate school in May of 2008. So go through the first part of the pregnancy. My due date was like February 22nd or something like that. And I remember saying to my doctor, I hope that, because it was a leap year. And I said, I hope that I don't go late and that I have this baby on leap day. And his immediate and just aggressive response to me was, a baby comes when a baby comes. You don't get to decide that. little did I know that that was going to be the least of my concerns at that point. But it just was one of those new mommy thoughts that goes through your head and you think, oh, I just wanted that baby to have this like a normal birthday, you know, not to have to contend with something silly that we made up to keep up with the rotations of the earth, you know. You know, just you think that's going to be the hardest part. It was not the hardest part. It was not even close. So at that point, you think the fertility journey is over. I've done the things. I have reached the point of pregnancy. I don't have to worry about I don't have to worry about ever going through this again. And that wasn't the case either. So it was, you know, the old adage of, if you want to make God laugh, have a plan. It was even to me, even bigger than that, because there was no way I could have anticipated what was coming next. So, yeah.
What came next?
We started the genetic testing, the pieces that you're supposed to do, right? The things that they think will keep you informed and ready if something goes wrong. And it was at the 16-week mark that the doctors noticed that he wasn't growing to the right levels. And by the 20-week mark, they were recommending termination because he was falling off the scales of growth and those kind of things. We knew at that point that we were having a boy. We had an amniocentesis because of these genetic tests that were coming back inconclusive and that something was wrong. So we knew without a doubt that we were having a boy. And it was something that I wished for from the very beginning. I wanted a baby boy that had my husband's red hair and his eyelashes. Again, when you're not clear with the wishes, you get exactly what you ask for. And that's exactly what I got. But I got a baby that was not healthy. So we continued on the path of not thriving, not growing, couldn't figure out what was going on. They didn't have a way to diagnose him in utero. So we just kept watching his little numbers go down and down and down, still healthy heartbeat. I went through that same gut-wrenching identity crisis again, where at first I thought I was less than because I couldn't get pregnant in the first place. And then no matter what I did, I thought, if I just eat more, he'll grow better. If I eat more protein, he'll grow better. They diagnosed me with an inability to metabolize folic acid. So while you're pregnant, that's all they're giving you is all these prenatal vitamins that are giant and huge and taste terrible, to get the folic acid into your body. And I wasn't metabolizing it properly. That had nothing to do with him, but somehow that was something that they diagnosed me with. And so I'm taking all this extra stuff to help. Maybe that's going to help him grow. Maybe something else that I do will help him grow. Maybe if I do cartwheels, which I was always terrible at cartwheels. I'm joking.
I was like, wow, that's a very niche.
Yes. It was a very, very precise medical opinion. Just kidding. That how can I be to hear? And I still can't. I can't even do this right. The thing that people have done for centuries and centuries and centuries, and including my own birth that was without mention, it was just a normal birth. So were my brothers and sisters. You know, it's just, how can I just not even do this right? And the fear that something was going to happen to him before I even got to meet him, the idea that I wouldn't get to hold him after all of this was just gut-wrenching all the time. We went to have a baby shower and our friends didn't want to come because they felt like it was for nothing, and that it didn't, they weren't sure what was going to happen to him. So how do you celebrate something that doesn't make sense? And so we kept going through the pregnancy, carried him to 36 and a half weeks, and went in for another ultrasound, and they unceremoniously told me that they thought I was leaking amniotic fluid, that I was losing fluid, and that he wasn't going to be able to stay in the amniotic sac for very much longer. So they sent me to the hospital that night, and the next day we had an emergency cesarean section, and he was born. And all I kept praying for the whole time was, please just let him cry. Let him be alive when he's born. No matter what comes after that, let him be alive when he's born. And he was, but only barely. He was quickly diagnosed with a form of dwarfism called primordial dwarfism. And there are separate types. So one type, and I don't remember the terminology, but I know which one was which, so I can at least tell you that.
Yeah.
When one had a average-sized head and brain, and then the body was smaller, okay? So that's the kind of dwarfism that you typically see very famous people, even non-famous people. There's reality shows. All of those are basically that type of dwarfism, where the center of the nervous system can do all the things that it's supposed to do. Just the body has its own challenges. The opposite one is what Porter had, and our son's name was Porter, and he had everything was small. His brain, his eyes, his ears. He had a club foot. He had a bifurcated thumb, where he had an extra thumb on one hand. He had a heart murmur. He had a hernia. He had digestive issues galore. And of course, this very small brain, where they weren't sure he would ever be able to hear or see or be able to smile or react to any of us. So, and part of that diagnosis, that was the most important part, is that he would probably not live to be a year old. So that's day one, January 24th, 2008. And I'm laying in a bed with sleeves on my legs to keep from getting blood clots. And I can't even come up with the energy and the hope to go and hold him, because I'm so overwhelmed with all of the things that we are finding out that now that he's born. And so it was, once again, now I'm a mom and I still can't protect my baby. I still can't help him. I still can't get him to healthy. I can't feed him enough. He doesn't care about eating. He had a feeding tube, of course, and breathing and all those things. His heart stopped twice in his first 24 hours. So he touched all of his nurses. They all just fell in love with him. In fact, because he had such an unusual case, there are NICU nurses coming out of the woodwork wanting to work his case, because when's the next time they're going to get to a chance to work on a dwarfism baby and to see that firsthand. And I firmly believe, I grew up Catholic, so I firmly believe that there's a hierarchy in the world, especially in the heavenly world, that there's God and Jesus that sit next to each other. And then the next level is the saints, because that's what we're taught in Catholicism. And then after that is NICU nurses, because they did everything for us that we could ever imagine. They, of course, kept up with him in the middle of the night. They helped me figure out how to breastfeed, and not even breastfeed, it was pumping, because he was way too tiny to do anything like that. But I was making so much milk, Shelby, that I couldn't, they didn't have room for it at the hospital. And so I had to keep it at home in a freezer at home with the little label on it with the date and the time and all the things. And he wasn't eating fast enough. So I'm just, anything I can do, just do the mom thing and just keep on doing it. And he was in NICU for 10 weeks. And I finally said to the doctor, I think I want to take him home. You're not doing anything here that we can't do at home. And he laughed at me, because there was so much going on with this poor child that he couldn't believe that I wanted to do that, that that was something that we really wanted to be able to do. But we were driving 45 minutes each way to go see him at this extra awesome special hospital in Atlanta so that he could have the best chance. And so we... I'm listening to the results of all of this effort, laugh their heads off downstairs. And so forgive me that I'm laughing. It's not a funny comment. It's not a funny subject, but I love that I can take a moment and have that perspective. Oh. That I can hear them and realize how far we've come. So we get him home. He was the sickest baby that this hospital had ever sent home from the NICU. And he weighed just under 3 pounds at 10 weeks old. He weighed less than 2 pounds at birth. He weighed 1 pound, 12 ounces at birth. So in 10 weeks, he had doubled his body weight, which was astronomically huge for him, being that, you know, he did not care about eating. He would drink an ounce at most. And we brought him home on a feeding tube, and they have these little mats that you can lay underneath the sheet of the bed so that if the baby's heart stops, it was meant to prevent like sudden infant death syndrome back in the day. You know, I say that like it was 100 years ago, Shelby.
I know.
It's even 20 years ago, but still. Yeah. But then that was a big deal to me, because I thought, how would I know if he stopped breathing in the middle of the night? But the mat was built for babies that are 5 pounds and up. And he wasn't big enough. So every little fluctuation in his movement would set the thing off. And he would think he wasn't breathing, or that his heart wasn't beating all night long. And so I threw that thing in the trash, because it was clearly not doing anything. It was hysterical to me, because it would start beep, 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 beep. And you wake up and start to freak out. You know, you jump around and you look at him, and he's just laying there blinking up at me like, what, mom? Why are you freaking out? I'm just hanging out. I'm good. Brian's graduating from graduate school. We're trying to figure out where we're going next. You know, where are we going to live? How we're going to live our lives and all that stuff. And meanwhile, I'm just surviving. I'm literally just day by day surviving to try to make sure that I get him where he's supposed to be. At the 4 month mark, he decided he didn't want a feeding tube anymore. And he stopped letting us put it in his mouth. He would hold his throat closed and wouldn't let us do it. We've had all the tests. He can hear, he can see, still has the heart murmur and the hernia, and they want to fix things like the club foot, but he can't go through surgery because of the hernia. Because of the heart murmur. Can't fix the hernia because of the heart murmur. We need to keep him on fortified formula. The digestive doctor was so adamant with me that I was doing the wrong thing by not keeping him on a feeding tube, that he wouldn't eat enough on his own. But what was happening was, with the feeding tube, when it is constantly going in, it's also constantly coming out.
Yeah.
And so he had skin integrity issues. He was constantly just covered in diaper rash, and his skin would break down. And we had this special compounded lotion that we had to put on his bottom to keep his skin from breaking down. And so when the feeding tube went away, I said, this is his choice. It's not my choice. And nobody could understand that because it was like, how do you know? He's this tiny little baby. But I had to believe that he had a say. I had to, or I couldn't take all of that responsibility. It was too much to bear. So I had to believe that he was trying to tell me something. I had to believe that he was trying to keep me from taking that on when it wasn't necessary.
Hmm.
So over the summer, my husband had started a job as a physical therapist, and some of his coworkers, of course, knew about Porter and about all of his challenges. And one of the things that he was the most challenged with was he had really tight muscles in his arms, especially, and it was painful to him. If you tried to move his arms, he would cry. And so they custom made splints to put on his arms so that it would just gently release that tension in his arms. And by the end of the summer, he could lay still with his arms extended and wasn't having that kind of pain. And it was so cool to just see that metamorphosis happen, you know, where he could be and not feel so uncomfortable just living his life because it was uncomfortable enough as it was. I mean, when we first brought him home, he was in micro preemie clothes. I didn't even know there was a such thing as preemie clothes, let alone micro preemie clothes. When I heard that there were preemie clothes, I thought, really? You don't just like put them in a onesie and that just counts, you know, wrap them up in a blanket? Because who cares? You know, they'll grow. Micro preemie clothes that were 1 to 3 pounds. And then we graduated into preemie clothes, and then we graduated into newborn clothes right before he passed away at 9 months old. Newborn clothes, and he was 9 months old.
Wow.
Hey there. It's Angela from Been There, Done That. If you're navigating the wild, unpredictable world of grief, I want to invite you to something special. It's called Messy Mornings, and it's our free weekly newsletter filled with real talk, gentle reminders, and support that actually meets you where you are. Each week, I'll send you stories, reflections, healing prompts straight to your inbox. No fluff, no pressure, just the space to release, feel, and heal. You don't have to do this alone. Head over to donethatpodcast.com and sign up for Messy Mornings. It's totally free, and it's made with you in mind. I've been there, and let's walk through this together.
So at 9 months old, I went to visit my sister for lunch one day. She lived in Mississippi and we were in Atlanta. So we met halfway in Birmingham, Alabama, and had lunch with some friends. And on the way home, I prayed. At the time, I felt like it was the most strong prayer I'd ever prayed, even during all of the infertility times where I was begging to be a mom, that he wouldn't suffer anymore. And I didn't know, once again, that I needed to be specific in that prayer. Because when I woke up the next morning, he hadn't woken me up like he had for the past 5-6 months since he had come home from the hospital. I sat straight up in bed and ran into his bedroom, and he wasn't breathing. I picked him up and I rubbed his arms, thinking that maybe what I was feeling wasn't not breathing, that maybe he was just cold or something else was going on because his skin was cold. I leaned over and I put my face up against his face and I couldn't feel breath. I couldn't see his chest rising. So I ran back into the bedroom and I woke my husband up and I said, I don't think he's breathing. he confirmed. He took him from me and was like, no, he's not breathing. I'm going to do CPR. You call 911. That still gets me to think about it, to remember that moment, that he had just passed peacefully. He didn't need to tell us that he had had all the moments that he was going to have. We called 911 and they sent over, I swear, every single emergency vehicle that was in the county. It's so unfortunate when that happens, because this baby is like this big, and there's three fire trucks and two ambulances and all these grown-ups. And I hate to break it to you, but this baby is this big. Where we stopped the resuscitation because it wasn't happening, obviously. And calling people and saying, I don't know what to do now. I need you to come over here because Porter's gone. Going through that piece, having a funeral, doing all the pieces that go along with that. And then once again, Shelby, I'm back in the position of, I couldn't do it. I'm still back in the position of, I couldn't even do this right. And meanwhile, I didn't go through any of his stuff. His room stayed exactly the way it was. I just closed the door and did my best to just grieve and do the best I could at that point. People would say to me, why don't you join a support group for parents that have lost a child? Like, I don't want to do that way. I don't want to be around people that are in it. I want to be around all the people that are past it, so they can tell me what I have to do to not feel this all the time. That's not how it works. But that's what I thought.
Yeah. Give me the recipe, the fix on the other side, so I can just.
Exactly. It was like the getting the card in Monopoly that says, go straight to go. Pass all the rest of the board and all the hard stuff that you have to do and go straight to go and collect your $200. That's what I kept thinking was going to be the easy way, the way that I could get there. And so then again, back to my earlier point, that I thought, I'm done. I'm a mom now. I did it. Now that wasn't the case. Now I'm back to, okay, so now what do I do? Now what do I try again? Do I do this again? We were told at the time that he was diagnosed with the dwarfism, that there would not be a way to test future babies to see if they had the same gene. And that we would not be able to know if either one of us was the carrier or if it was a combination of us genetically that was making the dwarfism gene. So we didn't know that part. I noticed one night, I don't even remember when it was, but it was sometime early in 2009. That I was laying on the couch watching TV and my husband was in another room doing something else. And that had been happening a lot more lately than I wanted it to. And so I thought, well, let's jump back in then. Let's just do this again. I fell for the oldest trick in the book, that if we just had a baby here, then that would seem somehow make things better, different, whatever, right? So I did all of that and we tried again. We used our own embryos that were frozen and thawed out a few of those babies and did the transfer again, still going through in vitro, still doing the shots, still doing all the things that go along with that process. And I got pregnant the second time in the fall of 2009. And that pregnancy was a lot different. I just never felt okay. It just always, and I thought it was because of grieving. I thought it was because of my body still probably keeping the score, as they say, about the grief and the trauma of all of that. I was willing to soldier through. Mm-hmm. If it worked one time, hopefully it'll work the second time. And the pregnancy was harder. I was sicker a lot. I was just ultra tired, just couldn't seem to get the energy back that I felt like I had the first time. And I went in for my 12-week ultrasound, and I prayed that there would be a heartbeat. And there was not a heartbeat. And so I felt like I was being prepared for that with that prayer, that I was being told that that probably wasn't going to be the case. And I was by myself. Brian was at work. And so I had to call him, say, yeah, now we're going to go through a different process where they go in and take the baby away because it's not alive anymore. And here we are again, back at the repeating story of not feeling worthy, right? I mean, mm-hmm. I just keep having this same, the same end to this, to a different chapter where I keep saying, yeah, but if I just try this a different way, maybe it'll go better.
What, when you mentioned the first baby shower and your friends not being certain they wanted to be there, they didn't know if that was something they could support. What was your dynamics like with your friendships the second time around?
Almost everything was shattered to pieces. I mean, even my relationships with my siblings were completely different. I didn't have the capacity. And my brother and his wonderful wife had two children by then. And I couldn't even enjoy my niece and nephew. So it was, nothing was the same. I was still Ange, but I wasn't ever going to be the Ange from before. And that was a really hard thing to get my head around. People that didn't know us would ask us questions. Do you have any children? No. Why not? Don't you like kids? Yeah, but I don't really want to go into the whole thing with you. All of the people that Brian was in PT school with went on, you know, because they all graduated at the same time. They all moved on, and some of them were around when Porter passed away. But for the most part, the thing that was the most consistent for us at the time that we had him was not there anymore, even before he passed away. So we didn't, our whole dynamic of friendship was completely different then.
What was your relationship like with Brian through that arc of experience?
Yeah, it was really hard to not experience it in the same way between the two of us. So I was taking it more personally that I couldn't, as did he, in a way that he couldn't protect him. But we couldn't even talk about it with each other. Because again, I go back to the prayer that I prayed the day before. I didn't actually tell him that that prayer happened until right before our kids were born that are here. And that was 10 years later. So I had all of this guilt and shame around what I had asked for, that it came true, that I had somehow affected the fact that he wasn't here anymore. And it completely created this chasm of space between us that he didn't even know existed. He thought we were just grieving and that we were continuing down a path. I resented him for, if he ever laughed, I resented him for that. I couldn't understand why he didn't want to try again and have another baby. But then when we did it, we lost that baby too. And then that, I felt like that was my fault too. And all of this was what I put on myself though, Shelby. This was not a conversation that we had. It was not something that I went to him and said, here's the way I think you feel. Is this true? None of that was happening because I wasn't healthy enough to go there. I wasn't able to take time to let's find out where Ange is. Let's get inside there. That was way too scary and way too painful to dig into that. So then that affected everything, not just my marriage, which of course was the number one relationship that I was in, but it affected all my friendships, my relationships with my siblings, my relationships with my parents. It affected all of my decisions because I started to think, well, there's not a real way. I shouldn't plan for anything because you don't know what's going to happen. I don't want to save money. I don't want to have things in place. But all the while I kept saying things like, we need to make sure that the next car has enough space for car seats. And we can't buy a small house. We have to have a house big enough to have a family in. We have to have space. All those kinds of things were coming out of my mouth. But on the inside, it was all shame and brick walls and trying to hide.
That sounds like such a dualistic, like it's just these two alternate realities and the weight of you carrying this story. Like I can only imagine for carrying a private secret monologue of, I prayed that prayer for him to go peacefully and no one knows. Like just that sense of making a story around, was it my fault? Was it that prayer? What did I do if I hadn't have done that?
Yes. And looking at it now, I think, my goodness, think a lot of ourselves much? Mm-hmm. Like, how could you possibly have had that kind of authority over his body? You couldn't. You didn't go in there and do anything to him. You just prayed a prayer. And while I do believe in the divine intervention of prayer, it's not that. It's that would have happened whether I would have prayed my prayer or not. It wasn't about me praying. And on the contrary, I only wanted him to not suffer. It was about his sweet little body was just struggling all the time just to keep its little heart beating and just to keep its, you know, eating food and doing all the things that most babies just do. Mm-hmm. It was hard for him. All those normal things were hard for him. So it wasn't about me. But yet in those moments, it sure did feel like it because those two things were so closely connected in my heart that I thought, nobody's going to understand why I prayed this prayer. Nobody's going to understand and want to understand how I could possibly have prayed that and the next morning him be gone. Mm. So.
Did you have dreams about him after that?
Yes. That is a really awesome question. And I remember having dreams of him being in a car seat and Brian and I driving down the road, almost like the end of a book. You're driving off into the sunset and then the end, you know, there's this beautiful sunset in front of you and you're just driving and everything is great. And I couldn't see that for the beauty that it was because I was so in my own junk that all I could see was, well, that's horrible. Why would I dream that? I'm going to sit here and wallow in it some more and feel terrible. And because I did the wrong thing and I prayed the wrong prayer.
Mm. Well, and it becomes a feedback loop. It becomes a neural wiring where we almost find ourselves in, well, I have found myself in a cycle of the doom and gloom, the self-loathing, the how could you, the I don't deserve. But then it becomes this baseline that until for me, when there's been big dramatic. It had to be something dramatic to pull me out of my spiral. What was your journey of, how did you shift from being in that type of headspace?
I started to think about not being married with more happiness than not being a mom again. And that if I just was with someone that wanted to have babies more, then everything would work itself out. And I started making terrible decisions for my marriage and terrible decisions for my own heart. I was making decisions that were not in line with my values. I just didn't care. Because at that point, my resentment had gotten to be so big, it was anything to deflect from feeling terrible about myself. So if I could just put everything that I was feeling on him, then that meant that it was all his fault, that he had withdrawn from me in his grief, and that this was the way that this was supposed to go. And when he confronted me about the people I was talking to and the decisions that I was making, it literally was like a light switch, that all of a sudden I could see all the dark and dusty and cobwebby places in my soul and realize that I was creating this construct to feel better about where I was. And that's when I told him that I had prayed the prayer. And he said, wow, that's really powerful, that timing is really unfortunate. And it was, I don't know those were his exact words, but that was the message that he was trying to get across to me, that, wow, that's kind of harsh, right? That you prayed that prayer and then the next day he was gone. I thought, that is, you have no idea what an understatement that is, my friend.
You're like, that is the understatement of all understatements.
I have literally been killing myself from the inside.
Yeah.
Without razor blades, without blood, because I felt so deeply responsible for something that I had no control over whatsoever. And yet I was blaming myself for something that I did not do. And here we were at this broken place. And it brought me back to the counselor, the bereavement counselor, when we first lost him, saying, well, how do you guys feel? We're like 3 weeks in, Shelby, like so early on in the process. How do you feel? Just so that you know, 75% of parents that lose a child don't stay together. And it probably was a bigger number than that. And then fast forward to that moment when he's coming to me saying, why are you having conversations with other people and not with me? Why are you dreaming and scheming about another life when I'm right here? Mm-hmm. And you're not present for us. Why is that happening? And when I admitted that to him, and he was like, wow, that's really powerful and really unfortunate timing, that I thought, I've been doing this to myself this whole time. This is me. This is my junk that's getting in the way of having friendships, of having a stronger relationship with my husband. This is all my own perception of what I think people will say when I tell them this is what happened. And it shook me to my core, completely rocked my world. And he wasn't willing to forgive me right away. He wanted time to consider, which I thought highly of then, and I continue to think highly of, because I don't know what I would have done in that situation. Yeah. And he said, we were in a couples therapy, so we were doing the work and had been for a year. Meanwhile,
going
I'm doing
weekly, bi-weekly.
Yeah, at least weekly. We were probably going twice a week at first. And then, and I'm still scheming my own life over here the whole time. And when we came back together right after the confrontation happened and after he questioned me, and I told him I did not want to be married to him. I wanted to be with him. We came back to counseling probably a week, maybe 10 days later. And he and our counselor said, you just have to try a tiny piece at a time to get back what you thought you had. And it's never going to be normal, or, you know, what is never going to look exactly the same way, but you just build back, you know, a tiny Lego brick at a time and get back to where you were. And that's what we did. We had already, before that, had gotten to that point, to that low of a point in our marriage, though, we had already started the process and had already started talking to each other, albeit very distantly, because we weren't connected to each other, about this concept of embryo adoption. And it was essentially another round of in vitro. Mm-hmm. But what it allowed for us to do was to have healthier genetics in the process. So our genetics, we always happily, heartily said that we didn't make healthy babies. And based on what happened with Porter and then with the second baby, we just didn't feel like, number one, it wasn't fair to us, but it was infinitely less fair to a baby to try to bring another baby into the world that would have as many challenges as their big brother had. And so we were down the path of embryo adoption. And at the time, again, I don't know that this is the same way it is as it was then, but you still did a home study where somebody comes out and assesses your home, and we had to have a fire escape plan and a high fire extinguishers for specific rooms and all this cool stuff that you think, what does that have to do with anything? But okay. And create your profile. And at the time, because, you know, we had internet by then, it was pretty robust by then, but it was still a paper book. I mean, it was papers that we emailed to the lady. She printed them out. She stuck them in a portfolio, the whole thing. We had already gone down that path and were 90% of the way finished. So once we had our major schism as a married couple, obviously all of that went on hold and nothing happened with it. And then when we felt like we could come back together, I didn't bring it up again because I felt like what was more important was focusing on each other and making sure that we could make a healthy go of it before we did anything that had anything to do with children. And I was so broken at that point, mentally and physically, that it truly was important to me, but it wasn't urgent like it had been. A couple of months in, we jumped in and we made the decision to finish our embryo adoption process. We had already worked on live birth adoption, and we just were beyond disheartened by the process, that it was just, we went to one agency interview and the founder sat in front of us and said, okay, everybody, there are 25 families sitting there, all as hopeful and as nervous as they could possibly be. And she says, how many of you would have said yes if I told you there was a baby born this morning that needed a forever home? Every single hand goes up. How many of you would have said yes if I told you it was a boy? Mm-hmm. Then like 2/3 of the hands go up at that point. Then how many of your hands would go up if I told you that baby was black?
Mm-hmm.
And most of us still raised our hands, even the ones that maybe didn't care whether they were having a boy or a girl, or they did care, you know? And she said, the cool thing about this is I can get you that baby for half price. And I actually threw up in my mouth, Shelby. I sat there and thought and said, oh, we have to leave. I can't. After all that we have gone through, for her to sit in front of us and talk about a human life based on how many dollars it costs, and that I can get a discount if I'm willing to take, I mean, I still get chills just saying it out loud. If I'm willing.
You said that.
Yeah. It was disgusting, to say the least. It was disgusting. There were Black families in the room. And she's still saying this, like, the good news is I can get you a discount on a baby that nobody wants. And so then we move into the embryo adoption stage, and we go back through the in vitro again, and we do all the things, and we go in for our first ultrasound, and the doctor says, okay, so here's one yolk sac. There's a heartbeat. Oh, look, there's a second. Oh, wait, there's a third. And my mouth fell open, and my husband just started laughing, an only child, mind you. And he just started laughing. And of course, they started asking me questions again about, you know, do you want to selectively reduce to because three babies at once is a high risk pregnancy. And so they, it was a concern for my own well-being and for the well-being of the babies. And so I said no, because I thought, honestly, whatever the plan is, I want that to be the plan. I don't want to intervene at this point. I just want to just let it do. So we did.
Just the weight, though, of like that scenario of people even offering, like, you know, if you'd like to, you know, just selectively choose, and just to have that question presented to you after losing your son. And like, that is such a mind melting scenario to even be faced with that question.
It really was. And I don't ever want to judge anyone for any decision that they make for their own body and their own family. But for me, it was, and in fact, I distinctly remember saying, I will answer this question this one time. Please don't ask me again.
Cool.
Not because I think I'll change my mind, but I don't ever want to hear the words come out of anybody's mouth. I don't ever want that to be something that I have to try to answer again after all of the things.
How did you start mentally preparing for the possibility of triplets?
That was the hardest part, honestly. I remember being in the shower one day and praying again. You know, I really just wanted twins, but you can't take it away now. I'm in love. You can't undo this now. I know better. Just saying things like that out loud was too much. I had too much of a power trip, thinking that I could make things come into fruition.
Oh my God.
So I was like, no way. I'm not praying that. I take it back. And it was really the first thing that went through my head, Shelby, honestly, was, oh my gosh, they're going to all be toddlers at the same time. They're going to all be 3 years old at the same time. And I still joke to this day about when they turned 4 years old, running around in circles with my arms in the air, because I thought, if I am not in a straitjacket by the time they are four, I will consider this entire thing to be a victory. It doesn't matter about any of the rest of it, but if I am okay, and so are they at 4 years old, I think we can do the rest. But people, of course, they still say the goofiest things, as I know they say goofy things to you too, that I would have killed myself if I had had triplets. I don't know how in the world you do this. I would have gone crazy by now. Are they natural? But you had fertility treatments, right?
Oh.
That's why you have three. And I say, and we, luckily by then, there was a ton of options for communication and a ton of fellowship that you could get from social media, especially. And I happened to be in the market for a stroller, which was a really hard thing to do with three babies. And so I happened to find a stroller that was in Clemson, South Carolina. So I drove down to get the stroller from where we were in Asheville, North Carolina at the time. And I thought that if that's the closest, if that's the furthest I have to go to get this awesome stroller, I'm going to do it. Drive down there. And she said, did you know that there's a triplet mom group for babies born in 2013? Because her babies were born in 2013 also. No, I did not know. So we get into the group. And the first thing that everybody starts complaining about is what people say to each other in public. And what the horrible things that we say. And for a long time, I would deny that we had fertility treatments. I would tell them, I would say things to make me look as normal as possible, not thinking about the fact that my children are hearing me answer those questions inaccurately. And what that does to their opinion of themselves, even though they were way too small to know the difference. By the time they were big enough to know the difference, I did too. And I was doing better. Because I'm the one that has all the baggage around having babies. They don't. They got pregnant easy. And so they didn't have all the diagnoses and the awesomeness that comes with the things that our bodies can do wrong.
Well, it's just crazy that where my mind goes is what do you make it mean that I have three children that were born at the same time? What do you make it mean about me? You know, what do you make it mean about, what does it mean for your kids if I have three kids? Like that's a very mind-boggling. I can so see that face, you know, oh, but like you, it was IVF, right? Like who was your doctor? You know, like there's jokes like that in Charleston for, you know, one of the doctors that gets everybody pregnant. And it's like, there's tons of twins, you know, it's a successful clinic, but just the scoffing air at it. And I think that being someone that's gone through my own infertility journey, and for those of us that have our own path with that, it's just like, when I see that, it's like you created, like you were brave enough to create what you wanted.
Thank you. That's a really, really kind way to respond to that. And what I loved when people would come over to me and say, you're doing great, mama. You have a beautiful family. Great job. When they would say stuff like that instead of, holy moly, are they all the same age? Because my daughter has brown hair and the boys are identical twins. Okay. So we put two embryos in, and the boys split really early on because they were all in separate sacs and all had a lot of safety around that. And it really was the most miraculous way to do that. But they would look at her and think she was older, and that maybe she was 9 months older than them, and that they weren't actually triplets. And they'd ask me if I was crazy. They'd ask me if, I bet your hands are full. And so then we created this other mantra that, yeah, but our hearts are full too. And we're blessed to be in this position, even though our lives are crazy chaotic and we don't know it any other way. We're just going with the flow as best we can, just like you were when you got pregnant easy, just like that. It's just that we didn't have that experience. And I had plenty of moms that I was in our wonderful triplet mom group with that had spontaneous triplets that didn't have fertility treatment. But because that's so rare, they got lumped in with the rest of us. And we were all, you know, we had unnatural babies. And one of our moms would say, they are natural. They are human beings, not robots in any way. They're not even cyborgs. They are full humans. And it would really catch people off guard because they're like, that's not what I meant. Oh, we know what you meant, but it doesn't matter. Good. It doesn't matter what you meant. What you say has, like you said, it has this connotation. It has this judgment associated with it that I know I took so personally because of all I had gone through. I know that there was a level of defensiveness that I couldn't have gotten rid of even if I had been aware of it. But it's the lack of awareness in the asking of the question. I had one woman argue with me that the boys weren't identical. But yeah, it was, that was the biggest challenge I had once I had them. Besides the obvious physical challenges of, I only have two hands and two boobs.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I have three mouths. So what do I do now? you know, how do I do all three at the same time? Or how do I figure this out? And luckily, they were also in the NICU for a while. They were born at 30 weeks because I had preeclampsia. So I had good help at the hospital where they were teaching me strategies and different things that I could do. I basically got to a point where I would rotate. One baby would get breastfed for a whole day. And then the next day would be another baby. And then the other two would get bottles. And the concept, even when we had them, that people would say, well, how much did they weigh when they were born? And I was about 3 pounds a piece. And I'm like, oh, okay, well, my first baby was 9.5 pounds. So that makes sense. Unless your baby had 6 arms and 6 legs and 3 heads, then it's the same thing, because it's not. And I never wanted to judge other moms, because I never wanted to be that person that was like, oh yeah, well, I'm extra cool because I have my 3 babies at the same time. You know, I never wanted to do that. I wanted it to be an open conversation, and I wanted us to be able to connect. And yet there was always this level of somebody else putting that obstacle in between us that was like, yeah, but you're crazy. You're crazy.
It's like, what does somebody expect when they say, oh, you're crazy? And then you're like, yeah, when the full moon comes out, watch out. Like, I grow and go for gallivanting. Like, I think that, yeah. I think reflecting on that, I think that some people, one, they don't think their thought all the way through. They don't think of what is the actual impact. I think it's a baseline curiosity met with just not a completely thought through thought. Until you go through challenging things and you realize that life isn't black and white. And before I'm going to just jump in and say something impulsive, maybe I'm going to pause and realize like, oh, wait, I don't know what she went through to get there. Good job, mama.
Instead of saying, how come you don't have kids? Don't you like kids? But rather asking a more kind question. Super cool. What's your journey been like?
Yeah.
What's that been like for you? And I remember one of my sisters saying to me, but you got to travel before you had kids and I didn't get that chance. And it's all about perspective, right? It's all about that piece that you can say. I mean, I look at you and think, my goodness, the beauty that comes out of Shelby when she does anything that I've seen is just absolutely mind-blowing to me. And I look at and I think, but she has had her own painful journey that she's grown through and made decisions about that I couldn't make for myself. I didn't make those decisions the same way. And it's to me about connecting anyway, even if the thing that you chose is not the thing that I would have chosen, but that I can find the beauty in your story and that I can connect with you at a different level and see your success and cheer for you and be excited for your life and your continued journey and what I see as a bright, huge, beautiful world that I don't have to judge. It's not my life. It's yours. I can just say, that is so beautiful and brilliant. And I'm so glad to know you. And that's it. I don't have to insert myself into it. I don't have to rescue you from it. I don't have to fix it for you. You are whole, just like this.
Mm.
And that's the part that I think people miss, is that we don't want to connect with each other if it means we have to be vulnerable. We only want to connect if it's easy and simple and it's at the surface, or we want to connect on hard things, but only if it's exactly the same. Our situations were identical in every way. And I just think there's more fun in finding each other and being able to have moments like this, because I haven't gotten the chance to tell my story this fully ever. And the only reason I am is because you offered to lead it and host it. And we wouldn't have met had it not been for the story that each of us carried to this point. We wouldn't even know each other. And we didn't have to be open to talking about it. We could have gone on our separate paths down completely separate places in life, geographies, relationships, all the things. And yet here we are. And if we can find those connection points, if we can find what's universal about ourselves, then we can have so much more beautiful of a life than if we close ourselves off and only think we're the only ones that are struggling or suffering. That's where we lose sight of the goal.
That makes me think of with your journey. I know that when you and I first talked, on paper, it looks like, wow, and Angie got her happy ending and it's all perfect for her. Do you find that your experience feels linear?
If linear means like those car commercials where the road starts at the top of the mountain and then continues to do hairpin turns all the way down the mountain, it's still one connected line.
Yeah.
But it doesn't feel that way when you're in it. And I've questioned several times, what in the world did I think I was qualified to do to be their parent? I hope I have given them at least some sort of peace, and hopefully the noise in the background assures everyone listening that they are happy kiddos. But it's that old saying, wherever you go, there you are. It doesn't matter that you got the thing, that you're at that point of where you felt like, okay, now I can say successfully, I am a mom. Because all my fear and all of my protectiveness and all of my junk came with me. I still had work to do. I still had things I needed to be aware of and to identify and to extricate from my life forever so that I could still be the best I could be for them and for my husband and for myself. And so so many people during the journey, and I know you can relate to this, would say, are you sure you're doing this because you actually want to have kids and you're not just doing it to fill a hole in your own life? That you don't want a child because you think that will somehow fulfill something about yourself. Mm-hmm. And I will tell you, and I have already told you, friend, that I questioned that mightily about myself. Please don't let me bring another human being into this world only for me to leave them emotionally or physically because I can't. I didn't do this for the right reasons. I need to be completely in all the way to the eyeballs in the mud for this thing to work. And that's what I think has been the hardest thing, is that I thought I had already done all the hard work. And then you get to be a mom and you realize, oh, no, that big trolley back there with all the suitcases on it, that's all your junk that you brought with you that came not just from the fertility process. Oh, no, there were plenty of other processes that you brought with you, too, that are all messed up. So now you have to unpack all that crap so that you can actually be a good human to the humans you brought into the world. And it wasn't what I expected.
What advice would you give to Angie when you were a year and a half into your marriage and things weren't just happening on their own? What advice do you wish you had heard?
Don't listen to all the people that say just drink 2 glasses of wine because it'll make all the difference. And try not to get lost. What I see looking back is that I lost myself in that process. I didn't consider a different path. I wouldn't undo it. I wouldn't do it differently, but I didn't consider that there was a different path. There was no other option for me. I could not see that. And I would have wanted her to be present in what was happening. I don't think I could have ever given her the advice to give up, because I just don't think that's in me. But I think that I could have been more present to enjoy the moments that were there, the traveling or spending time with my niece and nephew, spending time with my family, building my relationship, those kinds of things. I would have rather her not have lost herself in that process.
How has this journey made your life filthy rich?
I know that it's cliche to say that there are three of them and one of me. And I remember one of our good friends saying, you guys just went from man to man to zone defense. I thought, you know what? Come on. We had to be goalies with our bodies because there weren't enough hands. There weren't enough feet to keep everybody contained. But yet there are moments like every night before we put them to bed, our middle son asks me if I worked on my book today. And our youngest son, and I say those words because they're relatable to people. They're 1 minute apart. Like, saying youngest is kind of goofball, but anyway, our youngest son questions everything about existence and wants to be a lawyer when he grows up. And our daughter, I don't even have to finish a sentence and say, do you want to try blank, whether it be food or an activity or a sport or jumping off of a roof, doesn't matter. Whatever that end, that blank is filled in with, she says yes to it, no matter what. There's no risk. There's no fear. She wants to try everything in this world. She wants to be seven things when she grows up. And if that's not going to work out realistically to fit all of that in a 40-hour work week, well, then she just won't sleep and she'll just do the jobs anyway. It's the joy of watching them be humans that their brother could never have gotten to hear. He couldn't have a conversation. He wasn't going to be able to tell me if he fell down and got a scrape on his knee or if his belly was hurting him. None of that stuff would have been able to happen for him. So the joy of it now, albeit incredibly hard and chaotic and difficult, is just the fact that they're average. They're just plain old human beings. And I have the utmost blessing of just being able, like I said, to be the human goalie or the human bumpers on the bowling alley to try to keep them sort of kind of from hurting themselves too badly and sort of kind of living a life that they can make decisions for themselves and be able to move forward. And I question myself all the time. I am constantly trying to find the better way to do something or the way that I'm messing something up and how to fix it tomorrow. But they just care that we're here and that we're all safe and that we all care about each other and that we're doing this life together. And it's really, really fun to be a part of. Really fun.
How do you tell your three children about their big brother? How do you honor his life with them?
From the day that they could understand, we explained to them that he existed and that they had another sibling that we don't know if it was a girl or a boy, and that they are in heaven already. And they actually talk about Porter as their angel brother, and they consider him to be almost like a guardian angel, that he's there with them all the time and looking out for them. And they have always known that he existed. Sometimes get really sad about the fact that they never got to know him and never got to meet him. And other times are elated to talk about him. They name their stuffed animals after him, just crazy stuff like that.
Yeah. That's beautiful. What a beautiful way to just spearhead the narrative that they get to embrace as their own. And that's beautiful. Well, I want to land this plane with asking you, just even if this is a helpful soundbite for you to use, why did you want to launch this podcast?
I wanted to connect with people specifically on this topic because I felt like there's still a stigma around it and that people don't feel like they can talk about the inability to have children and what options are available to them. We didn't have as many options when it was my turn as people do now. But I wanted to be able to do that. And it never occurred to me that it was a grief story, ever. I really thought, just like you described it earlier, that it was more about the running through the tape at the end of the marathon. Look what I did. Look how far we came from the beginning to the end. But there's so many pieces of it that speak to people that are in grief now, whether it be about infertility or not. It might be about their identity and who they are and what they identify with in terms of being a female. You and I have had this very in-depth conversation. Or it's about the fertility journey, or it's about losing a person, which I did also. Where is that connection point? And I just wanted there to be more opportunity to connect the dots and not have to have a stigma around it. Because I love that technology can bridge the gap. We don't have to know someone in common for us to be able to connect our stories. We are the perfect example of that. And that I have no idea how we would have met had it not been for the connection point of our story. And So I'm thankful that we have that ability with the internet to be able to connect to people across the world with this medium. And I think that was the thing that intrigued me the most about it, was being able to connect to other people, because it's a universal problem. Grief and trauma are universal. We cannot escape them. And trying to think that we're different from someone else that has already had grief or trauma only creates separation within yourself. And there's no reason to do that. We can help each other if we just are open enough to talk about it.
How can people reach out or be in contact to share their story or recommend the show to a loved one that can connect with this?
I have a website, donethatpodcast.com. And then the episodes are all out on Spotify. So you can also search for the podcast as Been There, Done That, spelled D-U-N-N. Podcast on Spotify, and you can find us that way. And I have an email address, donethatinfo.com at gmail.com. And then that would be a way that you could reach out to me directly if you wanted to talk and if you wanted to be a part of the podcast in any way, shape, or form. I would love it. I would absolutely love to connect to anybody that wants to have a say and share their story in any way.
Beautiful. Well, thank you so much for opening up the time capsule of how beautiful the mosaic of your experience has been. It has just been the biggest honor to get to have a tiny glimpse into your story. And I think I have just been crying my face off listening to your journey. I can't thank you enough for sharing the roller coaster and beautiful portrait that's been your life.
Thank you for offering. Thank you for sharing space with me. Thank you for having this community in this way, because you created the safe place for me to be able to do this. And I really, really can't thank you enough.